Welcome to Stargate SG Fun, a podcast about the original Stargate series. I'm Trishy Mattson.
I'm Andrew Pontius.
And I'm David Schaub, and my name is just difficult to pronounce.
Today we are talking about the last two episodes in Season 2 of Stargate SG-1, 1969 and...
Out of Mind.
Out of Mind. And we're doing deep dives, or deep-ish dives, on both of them. And so why don't you just start us off with a recap for 1969, David?
SG-1 accidentally gates to 1969, without a Stargate at the destination. I don't think we're supposed to think about that. They're taken prisoners because they're obviously Russian spies. They escape thanks to a bootstrap paradox and a very trusting Lieutenant Hammond. With a Zat gun, a garage door opener, and two timestamps, they journey across Vancouver, or the United States, with some hippie draft dodgers. They visit Catherine, figure out time travel, find the Stargate, where they should have arrived, and eventually go to the far future where Cassandra happens to be there to send them home. I love this ridiculous episode.
It is ridiculous, but lovable. I agree.
There are the episodes where I feel the writing is tighter, and while conceptually this episode has a couple really weird things that happen, the character writing I really, really like.
Yeah.
Tilk gets to be funny a couple of times, which I think is good.
I always appreciate that.
Without breaking character, he gets to be funny. So you really get to see what Christopher Judge has some really good comic timing. It's just criminally underused, but yeah.
Yeah, but it's well used here.
Mm-hmm.
Well, and he gets to have hair, and is it that they put a bald cap on him and then they put a wig on him, or did they just let him have his regular hair for this? I'm not good at judging those things.
I don't know. Did he actually shave his head for the show, or?
I assumed he had shaved his head. Otherwise, it is an immaculate cap.
Yeah.
Yes.
That's true. You wouldn't want to have to do that every episode. Get that.
So they probably just gave him a wig for it.
Gave him a big wig for his hair for that. Yeah. This is not the kind of episode that is geared towards my interests. And so I really didn't like it when it came out. I don't tend to rewatch it that much.
You mean your interests as a teenager or whatever when you were watching it? Or
little older than a teenager when I watched it. But
just in general.
No, it's just hokey travel montages and really, really fake looking 60s costumes and badly written hippies are just, you know, just don't do much for me. So, and also the ridiculousness of the time travel aspects of it, which we will get into. It annoys me when they do silly things like this to get to a certain place they want to be at. And they did a lot more silly things than they usually do to make this one work. But in the end, I mean, it's the love for this, for the characters and for the situation really does come through in this episode. The writers really enjoyed writing this episode, it feels like.
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
And they really enjoyed being able to weave in certain things, which we've already seen. So we got to see Catherine Langford, the younger actress who plays her, got some more work. And O'Neill's love of astronomy gets a bit of a workout.
Mm-hmm.
I actually think probably getting ahead of myself, but I do think that the thing that might have started the whole episode was them thinking about that line from Catherine Langford where she said, oh yeah, I started thinking about it again in the 60s. And, you know, Daniel even mentions, hey, maybe this is, maybe we did this, maybe we got this going. And I think, aha, when somebody said we want to send them back in time, where can we send them back in time where we get the most bang for our buck? That might have been how they started building out, oh, okay, well, if we need to do that, then we need to, you know, find these other aspects of it to make it work, to make this silly thing work. And that's where they all came from.
Speaking of getting their bang for the buck, though, both these episodes, I feel, were probably pretty cheap to shoot. And given that they are the last two episodes of the season, I kind of feel like maybe they spent most of their money up front. So that was kind of amusing. I mean, up front in earlier episodes.
Certainly they had to spend some CGI money on the season opener.
Yep.
They spent a lot of money on that, yeah.
But I don't remember any of the other episodes being particularly like, wow, they spent a lot of money on this.
I don't know.
So maybe they actually spent it all on season one. Who knows? Although season one was also very cheap looking, so.
Both of these episodes, you're right, though. They are very efficient in their set utilization. And when we start discussing the locations, they're pretty efficient in their set use, their location shots, too. The only thing that I thought was surprisingly expensive looking or just complicated is I have no idea where they got those engines that look like LR-87s that are like Titan first stage rocket engines. They looked really good. I don't know if they're right to scale, but geez, those looked good.
Yeah.
But it did seem weird having them in the bottom of a mountain.
Yes, yes. They had to lampshade that away.
Yes.
To have that moment.
But NORAD's been there since the late 50s. So,
hey, they got that right. Yeah.
Why not?
Okay, so first of all, they start off the episode with Sam's hand being burned. Is that a casualty of the previous episode where they were, where the Renau were invading the base?
The Ritu?
Ritu, yes, thank you. Or is it just an unexplained off-screen injury?
That's a good question that I have no idea about.
Okay.
That's about exactly what I was going to say. I do not remember. I mean, it's certainly possible.
Yes, I'm afraid it's been a while since our last podcast on this, so I it's been longer since I watched the previous episode, so I couldn't remember if we were supposed to remember some kind of continuity about an injured hand or not.
I don't think so.
The continuity inside of this episode is exceptionally tight.
Yes.
Continuity outside of the episode, a little fuzzier.
Okay, so let's focus on the continuity inside the episode. And I did like how they did with the, okay, Sam has a burned hand, and that triggers General Hammond's memory about being young lieutenant or whatever Hammond back in 1969 and the mysterious strangers that he encountered. So he gives Sam a cryptic note.
And he gives it to her very cryptically. Like, it's a really weird scene. The first time watching it, I'm going, what in the world am I looking at?
Right. Yeah, it's basically, don't look at this. You'll know when the right time is to look at it. And then she doesn't even look at it until after it's discovered by people going through their things after they're discovered. So
just discovered by Hammond.
Right, right. So yeah, I liked the loop on that. And then it turns out later that Sam had been researching solar flares and Hammond had told her to research alternate possible uses for the Stargate, and hey, maybe we could do time travel. And then it all turns out maybe he had a reason for making her do that research, because it turns out to be useful for their trip home. So I liked how that looped around.
I think Don Davis did a really good job with the acting on this one as well. And so yeah, he sold it.
Absolutely.
I did think young Hammond was a bit too tall. Too convincingly. I mean, he's got a heck of a senior slump if he...
Yeah, osteoporosis comes for us all.
But the young Hammond, I think, really just had the vibe of a Hammond.
Like,
he really did sell it, even if the height was wrong. It just, he kind of felt like Hammond.
The voice was pretty good.
And the voice was quite good, too. So I was really, really thought it was good. I was briefly wondering, you know, if this was in HD, we could have read that name tag way earlier. But there was no way to in the 90s.
The camera lingers on him a bit even before we see his name tag. So, you know, we know there's something up with this character. We just don't know what.
Exactly.
Right.
The time travel is very consistent with people who grew up watching Star Trek, I suppose. If you go really close to gravity wells and swing around suns, you can travel through time. You know, I can cope with that. It's silly, but I can cope with it. That is not the issue with this episode. The time travel is consistently full-on grandfather paradox. They even quote it.
Mm-hmm.
Everything magically has to happen this way because it happened this way before. That is not a bad model. It doesn't make any sense, but it's not a bad model. It's consistent. The going around the sun is fine. The using the solar flare, that doesn't really make a lot of sense. But hey, I'll even run with that too. But I will, as I mentioned before, just go, what in the world were they thinking when they had them walking through the gate or into the gate room and then have the gate room dissolve?
Yeah.
What did anyone first watching this episode thought was going on? Because there's no way to connect these two things.
Right. And well, and I've said this in other episodes where it seems obvious they were connecting A to B to C in order to get what they wanted. And in this case, they went with something completely nonsensical because otherwise they'd never have met Lieutenant Hammond.
Yeah.
And they really wanted that to happen. And they wanted it to happen so badly, they willed it to happen within the episode without there being any reason for it.
The problem was is they needed to get to Hammond, and they also needed to have to go somewhere to then go to the gate. Like, they needed Hammond and the gate to be far away from each other. And there was no way for them to do it. Like, this, they just gave up.
They just gave up.
They probably had, like, five versions of this story, and they're going, but we want this and we want this.
Yeah.
Screw it. They show up in SGC.
Oh, well, solar flare gate malfunctioned. Yep. Here they are. Let's go.
Exactly. But that does lead us into the first great Tilk moment in the episode.
Right. Yeah, I loved that. So they mysteriously appear inside a missile silo for a Titan rocket that's about to go off. They're counting down. They're pounding on the walls and screaming to be let out. And Teal'c just calmly takes his zap gun and zaps the Titan rocket. No more liftoff. So they're all safe for the moment until they get arrested.
It was a thing of beauty. That was just a great scene. And they then even put a little bow on it later when the thing wasn't going to go off anyway. It just didn't even matter. But that doesn't take away from just the beautiful, chill Teal'c taking out the problem.
Yeah, that was a perfect character moment, followed immediately by another perfect character moment where the airmen enter the chamber and a guy asks in Russian if they are Soviet spies, and Daniel, multilingual Daniel, of course, just says, Nyet.
Love that. And O'Neill just dies inside. It's so well played. And O'Neill's reaction is so beautiful. And then Jackson realizes it, and it's just this, it's just a few seconds of a scene, and it's perfectly played. It is just perfectly played.
Yeah, it's really efficient how quickly they did that character moment and how funny it was.
But also, this is the past, therefore we also have to see lots and lots of smoking.
Well, but people were smoking. Well, that's the funny thing. Like, I remember the movie, and the Stargate movie actually kind of feels like it was much longer ago than it was. It was like 1995, because everyone was smoking in that big conference room. Like, it was wreathed in smoke, that whole room. And I think they were kind of trying to show that this was a sort of a more, like, kind of old-timey atmosphere, like mindset from the military. Like, the military was not sort of necessarily up to date when it's mindset. But it's just so funny that then, like, 2 years later, 3 years later, they're making fun of the fact that somebody would smoke in a military installation when, you know, hey guys, you were just doing this.
I sometimes pretend that the original Stargate movie came out at that point, but it actually was set in the early 80s, which also doesn't make any sense. But what do you do?
Yeah, I was rolling my eyes pretty hard with the Captain Kirk Luke Skywalker thing. Like, you know, okay, yes, O'Neill is a smartass. Moving on.
Yeah.
Those were not the best jokes.
But of course, by 1969, Captain James T. Kirk should have been a recognizable name.
Should have been. Yeah. Well, they might not have. He might not have been much of a science fiction watcher, that guy. But yeah.
Mm-hmm. Sure, but still. Had they just done it once with Luke Skywalker, I would have been okay. I agree that the Captain Kirk one is just a step too far.
Yes. Yeah, some writer just felt like they had to be really clever.
But I really liked the line where O'Neill is asked about the Zat gun, and he says, it's hard to say. Some kind of state secret? No, just difficult to pronounce. Which is perfect.
That was great.
Right. I forget what the original name for the Zat gun is.
You mean
the
Zat Nikatal?
Yes, that's it.
Yeah. I remember a Teal'c pronouncing it, and it will never leave my mind at this point. So, yeah. The closed captions apparently didn't quite know how to spell it, but I remember it enough. So.
The closed captions for the show I have found previously is being just horribly, horribly wrong. Mm-hmm. So I'm trying not to watch them anymore. It's just, right. They're just misleading. They lie to me.
They do. Like Jack O'Neill talking to an Army investigator. Excuse me, Air Force investigator. They got in the truck, right? And is that going to be one of... No, that's probably not going to be one of your shooting locations, right? Because it's just a road.
Yeah, but it is a road, and really almost every highway and road in BC between cities looks like that. Yep. Like, it still looks like British Columbia. That's what the roads look like. That Route 66 sign, they moved it around a lot. But still, it's a very fake-looking sign. We'll get to the location shoots.
I guess Hammond, sabotaged the tire somehow?
Right. He had seen the note to trust them.
Yeah.
And in his own handwriting, and just on the basis of that alone, he decides to sabotage his own career and rescue these guys. Of course, it turns out okay in the end.
It's a question I think you have to ask when you're watching this. Does Hammond really buy into it too easily?
Yes. The answer to that is yes.
I can kind of see him stopping it to give a moment. Like, he only stopped the vehicle by popping the tire to have the conversation, but without actually freeing them.
That's true. That's true.
But all he needed was initially, how do we prove we're from the future? Well, the moon landing just happened. That's not effective proof of anything. Very nicely written also. But being able to say where Hammond was when he was watching it.
Yeah, but like,
is that sufficient?
If they were conducting a spy operation on him, learning one thing about his life is not going to be that hard.
Yeah.
But yeah, right.
Yeah.
Normally, even in these sorts of shows, like, they have to say like two things or three things. And it's like, you know, the combination of all these things from different parts of their life are enough to finally convince them. And they just didn't have time for that with this. They're like, no, we're just going
to
use one.
They have to cover a lot of territory in this episode.
Yeah, the pacing of this episode is a strange one. I like it, but it is strange. And you have to accept that Hammond buys it really easily. Maybe Hammond's handwriting is very precise.
Well, it is true that there it would be weird. Like, how would they get his handwriting? Like, maybe somebody copied it. But again, like, you know, if this was a serious spycraft,
they could do it.
Operation, they could have done it. And
yeah, I don't know. It wasn't cursive, though. It was block letters, which would be a lot easier to fake.
Maybe Hammond is just really good at knowing handwriting. Yeah. It does nicely answer the conversation they had previously in the truck, whether there's any way they can get out. And I do like the line, where there's a will, there's an or.
Mm.
Carter tries to talk some sense into him, and he's not having it.
Nope, it will take no sense.
I did also appreciate the callback to the Zat Nicotel 1, 2, 3 shots thing.
They're very consistent.
Yeah. I think this is the only time that they explicitly use it, at least that I've seen, I believe, since. I don't know, maybe they did it in the last finale. But, you know, just I like that callback that they did. Okay, hey, we can get rid of things by doing this.
I thought it was a bit strange that the only things they took were the garage door opener, which I'm trying to remember if I knew that that's what a GDO stood for, and the Zat gun, and that's it. Like, they almost took nothing of their stuff, which almost surprised me. You think you'd want some more equipment, but safer to destroy it all. Leave no evidence.
And whatever cash Hammond had on him.
and all of Hammond's cash.
They wanted to destroy their guns, right? Because they're too new.
Yep.
And they probably had other... Do they have other equipment? Do they have, like, backpacks when they go to other planets?
They probably have Velcro, which was barely existing because it was developed as part of the Apollo program.
Oh, God. We are probably overthinking this. But anyway...
Yes,
we are. What do they do after that?
They decide to go find the gate.
Right.
Right. Well, they go to another highway and they try to flag down cars. Was the Samantha Carter scene where she's like on the road, that looked like sort of green screen. Like, was she not actually on a road?
No, I think.
And from those shots where like they show up behind her or?
I don't think it was. I think it may have just been the angle. I think that was real. They were on the streets anyway.
Yeah, right. Why shoot it different? Well, reshoots maybe, but yeah.
Maybe.
But I do like this was another moment where Teal'c gets to be funny.
Yes.
Where he's like, this isn't working. I'm just going to stand in front of a vehicle and make it stop.
Sam in her army fatigues is unsuccessful in the,
yeah.
You know, it happened one night maneuver. So yeah. She can't exactly raise her skirt and show a shapely leg to get someone to stop for them.
That was a weird thing. Like, did he get Sam to do it because... she's the small female and therefore less...
Yes.
Less threatening, more likely to get picked up
yes.
for a ride.
That seemed to be very deliberate,
she's
yes.
still in army fatigues.
Yes, yeah, yeah.
So Teal'c says, this is inefficient, and he just walks into the road and blocks traffic.
Then we come to probably my least favorite aspect of this episode, which is the hippies, who are cliched and very broadly drawn. And yeah, I mean, they just feel like they're there for the plot. And for the montage, because otherwise they are complete blank slates who are not really worth very much, except for that one scene near the end, which we'll get to.
I kind of like that they're going to Canada. It fit for the car trip through Canada.
Right. Well, they say first just that they're going to Woodstock.
Without naming it.
Or they don't say Woodstock. They say upstate New York.
They don't say Woodstock, but yeah, that's what they mean.
But that's what it is.
And Teal'c does wonder whether they are at war with Canada.
Yep. That was a fun line. I enjoyed that. Yeah. Was that the first montage? Yeah, they montage for a little while and they get new clothes. I think, again, the wardrobe people probably had as much fun with this episode as the writers because they never get to dress up,
right?
You know, SG-1 in fun clothing. And this time they finally got to dress them up in something new. Carter has those big glasses and I liked her outfit. And I liked Daniel's outfit too. I thought he looked sort of snazzy in like sort of this vest thing. I don't remember the details.
They definitely wanted clothes to fit the personality.
Yep.
And there was a lot of effort there.
Well, except for Teal'c. Teal'c was sort of looking like a, you know, I don't even know exactly what, but...
Well, Teal'c needed a headband to disguise the symbol
yep.
which I liked how they handled that too. The
yep, very nicely done.
The friendly hippie says, "What does that thing symbolize?" "Slavery to false gods." And he refuses to discuss it any further.
Which is fair.
Yes. Yes, but then he needs a headband so he doesn't keep getting asked that question.
And at this point, the party splits because they have to confirm the flare theory and they need to find the gate.
Oh, sadly, Jack did not get dressed in hippie gear. They made him more of a biker with a black leather jacket and blue jeans, which is, I get the sense, is kind of what Jack O'Neill would wear in civvy life anyway.
Or perhaps just what Richard Dean Anderson wanted to wear.
Right.
Yeah, I suspect that probably had a bit to do with it as well, yeah.
I think he just wanted to look cool. Jeans and a leather jacket will do just fine, thank you.
How did they know where to look on the sun? Like, the sun is a fairly big thing when you looked at through a telescope. Anyway, I'm overthinking it, but
they look at the edge because that's where you can see a flare most easily.
Yeah. And you have to ignore the stock footage of a flare. That's not what he saw.
Yes. Yeah. So Carter and Jackson go see Catherine Langford, and he says he's the son of somebody. I didn't catch who that was.
Oh, some German scientist who used to work with her father back in the old days.
Okay, so yeah.
I didn't catch the name.
Yeah.
By the way, this TV trope says the fifth actress to have played Catherine Langford, and her name is Glynis Davies, and I thought she was fine. They didn't give her all that much to
do. Is it not the same actress who did it in the flashbacks?
It is not.
What?
Nope.
Damn.
Nope.
This is like 5-10 years later, isn't it?
Well, yeah, but not that much later. I thought they would, you know. Okay, all right.
Pretty good facial matching, yes, acting was, you know, perfectly fine. Yeah. She was a perfectly fine Catherine Langford. I guess the other one may have been unavailable or something.
Well, you know what wasn't fine? Daniel's accent was not fine. Daniel's accent was deplorable. And why it would fool anyone, oh God. Yeah, that was another part where I was rolling my eyes really hard.
Which is really quite funny given the earlier line, "Well, I speak 23 different languages, pick one." He never said he spoke them well.
Yeah, right. Sure you do. Mein Vater. Oh my God, it was a Dein Vater. Yeah. Oh, okay. Anyway.
I get the feeling that he knows enough German to go to a restaurant and when there's an international conference in Munich or whatever.
Why would Catherine Langford tell a complete stranger the exact location of the gate? Why was he asking? Oh, it just kills me. I know they needed it, but it was just, there's no way in anything resembling a real world conversation, she would just tell him exactly where the gate was. This most treasured possession. It just kills me.
The problem is it's been like another decade where nothing gets done with it. And I expect, I mean, she's frustrated by it.
Yeah, it had been years and years since she had even thought about it.
And the military buried it, effectively.
Right. And I'm sure she's frustrated about the military burying it. And maybe wanting to poke things with a stick and see if things can get stirred up again.
If we can for a moment, we've had some montages, we've had some scenes. I'm afraid I have to discuss some of these location shots in Vancouver.
Sure.
Go for it.
Mainly because it's just so efficient. They go to a clothing store and then they go to a cafe to pick up some food. The cafe is Arbutus Cafe. It's about 10 blocks from me. It gets better. They then go on a bridge. It's the Burrard Bridge. That's only 6 blocks from me. Mm-hmm. On both sides of the bridge are 2 convenient locations. On one side is the Gordon Southam Observatory, which is the New York Observatory.
Oh, yeah.
And then on the other side of this bridge is the Seaforth Armory, which is Canadian Armory, that is the Washington, D.C. Armory. All of these sites are basically within 10 blocks of each other, including Catherine's house, which I thought was funny because it's 2 blocks south of the house I got married in.
Cool. Wow.
It's exceptionally efficient, even though they have to cross entire cities to get to the different locations. I might include some pictures with this episode.
Yeah. Sure.
In the episode, they show you that they're going to these different American cities by showing you brief snapshots of either like generic pictures.
And a map.
Of like St. Louis and like stock footage. And I'm like, wow, this feels really cheap. This feels like they made this on the slimmest of budgets. And yet this is the only time we get to see these people in what are supposed to be contemporary locations. Was after this the fire?
It was actually before that they had the campfire.
Oh, yeah. That was the one where they're like, take us with you because They said they were aliens, which I thought was fun.
Bizarre. Bizarre.
Bizarre, but also fun. Like,
right. So Sam is talking to the rest of the team about the solar flare probably caused the malfunction, and this is what we're going to do to try and get back. And it turns out that the hippies were listening, and Jack tells them, yes, they are space travelers. They need your help. They're a little unconvinced. Jack shoots a Zat gun at the campfire and makes it flare up to convince them that they're real, which, using a space gun, it seems like a really poor way to get peaceniks on your side. Look, I have advanced weaponry. That just didn't work for me.
I thought it was pretty good because it's the only thing that could maybe make it believable.
Well, it would certainly be a less scary way of convincing them than showing them Teal'c's snake in his belly.
Yeah, no kidding. That's a horror. I like how the hippies overhear the conversation, and then when they try and excuse that conversation and get around it, they don't buy it at all. Like, the hippies are absolutely sure that they're talking the truth. So the hippies seem with it and reading the room well, and then they entirely buy the alien story. But the Zat gun actually helped it for me.
When it, like, the Daniel is shown as kind of going over the top with it, like, your Earth City, New York or something.
Yes. Right, I heard that
so
one.
So, like, yeah, all right, Daniel, ran it in, Daniel. You're going a bit over.
But he would. It's in character.
It is in character. Yeah, yeah.
Right, so then it's after they have split apart and get back together again that the hippies say that they want to go with them.
Yep.
And Jack says, no, no, you have to stay. And then the girl says, I didn't ever hear the girl's name, but she says that her boyfriend, Michael, got drafted. He says he doesn't want to kill anyone. Jack is obviously about to have an outburst and dress this guy down for not serving his country or whatever, and Sam basically steps on his foot and says, hey, you have to make up your own mind, she says to the guy. And I rather like that we never find out what choice they made.
I also kind of like that we don't see Jack doing it. I think it makes it easier for the show, because they probably don't want to have Jack give that spiel. So I think it's very efficient having Carter cutting him off like that.
Yeah, that moment really, really worked for me.
Yeah. Okay. Well, remind me to talk about the time travel grandfather paradox kind of thing at the end of the episode, because this was another moment which really made me roll my eyes. It made me roll my eyes, but I did like the dramatic aspect of the moment, because this is like the one sort of deeper emotional moment of thing where something is really at stake here. And I did like that in a show that is mostly a comedic episode, that they did have a bit of that moment in here.
The Stargate science here at the end, which kind of broke me, was Carter's line, which I don't understand how either the actor or the character could say it with a straight face. General Hammond must have chosen the flares on the opposite side of the sun this time, so the sun's rotational differential will send us forward instead of back.
Yeah.
Try not to think about it.
I'll put up with the ridiculousness of this is the way we can excuse that we'll go the right direction through time.
We'll just fly around the Earth in the other direction.
Yeah, I'm okay with that. I'm okay. I can cope. It's Carter believing that General Hammond figured it out. That's the bit I can't cope with. What, General Hammond's been doing the math on this in the back for a while? Like, this is a pet project? I don't understand how they can just accept General Hammond as the best source of information on wormhole mechanics.
Right.
They had very few tools to work with to construct this episode, and they just, we're just going to shove these round pegs into these square holes just to make it all fit.
Right. They don't have a Starship Enterprise that they can use a slingshot maneuver around the sun to get back in time. So
it's ridiculous then, too. But yes, okay.
But on the other hand, you're right. They didn't have a lot of tools because they're apparently going to power a Stargate with car batteries.
Yes.
Oh, yes. Oh, my God. Oh, God. Okay. Yes, yes, yes. Thank you. Yes.
That one is like, yeah, no.
That's what broke me. I'm like, wait a minute. Yeah, a truck? Come on.
I think it was two trucks, and it was running. It was running. That helps.
It was running. Yeah, yeah. So they go through the Stargate. Carter is saying, like, it's got to be so precise. And then they're like, well, no, you've got to go now anyway. Well, if it's got to be so precise, then nothing you're doing is that precise. Like, you were never going to make it according to split-second accuracy anyway. Just, like, running. But anyway, okay, so they go ahead and
They also ignored the fact, if you want to get really deep, I'm sorry, but the timestamp for when the solar flare happens, that's after the solar flare happens, because you have to account for the time it takes for light to get to Earth. So they had to have actually timed it before then.
I'm not even gonna think about it, David. I'm just not gonna think about it.
That's okay, David, because the fluctuations that would happen to the Stargate take that long to get to Earth also. You know, it's all electromagnetic flux that gets there at the same time, the light and whatever energy affects the Stargate.
I just want to do one more thing, which is they fly through the gate and then the bullets fly through the gate with them. And I thought that was a beautiful little touch.
Right.
Yeah, that was fine with me. We've seen projectiles go through the gate.
Nice attention to detail. Those army guys, their aim is horrible. So let's get to Cassandra. It's ridiculous and I love it.
It is ridiculous, yeah. She's got the Nox thing that makes the gate do that thing, which we never see again. Anyway.
Well, we wouldn't, because it's however many years in the future.
It's in the future, yeah. But yeah, so she's like, oh, you gotta, I can't tell you anything. All right, so I'm gonna want to go about my time travel things now, okay?
Yes.
Go for it.
By all means.
So the show pretty much makes it clear that they're already living in the second timeline, because they already went back and they changed it such that Hammond already knows, and he lived with that knowledge and used it to change the future. So they've already changed the future. Carter's saying, well, the butterfly effect, we can't affect anything. You've already affected things by being in this van with these people for like 3 days. Like, that's not a butterfly effect. That's a T-Rex effect, to continue to use, elements from the story that they don't actually name.
Right. The sound of thunder. Yep. Go on.
Like, they have totally changed those people's lives in a way that will obviously make giant ramifications down the line, even not giant, but like, butterfly effects. It will ripple out and just change a whole bunch of things. Like, I get what Carter was going to say, that like, we can't actually actively fight to make things different, but they totally made things different by doing that. And the show shows that they made things different. And so, yeah, the whole thing about we have to not tell anybody anything, that was never actually that big of a concern.
Can I respond?
By all means.
Yes, I will cede the rest of my minutes to the Honorable Mr. Shaw.
Okay, I take the floor?
Yes.
So usually there are three ways of doing time travel. Two of them are consistent and one of them is ridiculous. The ridiculous one is Back to the Future, where things happen in the past and the future, and they somehow catch up to you sometimes inconsistently. Sometimes they matter, sometimes they don't.
Yeah.
Absolutely ridiculous. That's the ridiculous one. Now, there's the time travel I like. I like fully multi-dimensional timeline time travel. Every time you go back in time, you are creating an entirely separate timeline.
Mm-hmm.
Therefore, the things you remember aren't affected. And the show that did this really nicely was the Terminator Sarah Connor Chronicles.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
Because of that episode, they go back in time, they change the future. Someone else comes back in time after them. They remember a slightly varied experience.
Yeah, I remember that.
Because they experienced the changes from the first person who went back earlier.
Right.
So it's sort of every time you time travel, you create a timeline. This show, however weakly, does the third way, which is there's a single timeline. Everything has happened is going to happen. Paradoxes can't happen because they don't happen. And I think if you accept that the fact that this show is doing that, it's okay. But you have to buy into the fact that there is only one timeline.
Yep.
And it is all grandfathered. It is all bootstrapped. Hammond always wrote the note. Cassandra was always told when they were going to have to go back to do it. And everything always happens in one timeline. So if you buy that this is a single timeline time travel mode, the time travel is the least of this episode's problem.
Well, the other thing about it, though, is like the Hammond who they meet in season one, episode one, is obviously in a different timeline than this one. And that's what kills me the most. Like, you know, just don't write episodes like this when it's so obvious that it doesn't make any sense. That, he didn't remember them when he first saw them. He didn't remember Teal'c. And of course he wouldn't, because why would you write that into the beginning of a show that hasn't even happened yet? So, like, again, like, I know where they really wanted to use...
You are absolutely correct.
Yep.
They really wanted to use Hammond in this, but they shouldn't have. They should have used somebody else. They should have introduced a new character an episode earlier and had that character be the one that this happened with. They didn't want to do that, but it just kills me how they did it.
Or they should have just done it like Deep Space Nine's Little Green Men and had someone just decide to help them.
Yeah. It is definitively, as I said earlier in this podcast, this episode is very internally consistent. It is not outwardly consistent at all.
Yeah.
But I do like that it ends with Hammond giving the line, It's going to be a long debriefing.
Speaking of inconsistency, it also just bothers me that they put old future Cassandra in that white baggy gown thing. I just don't view that as anything that Cassandra would wear.
It's all the rage in whatever year that is.
Even 90-year-old Cassandra or whatever she was supposed to be. It just looks...
Well, this show's idea of what futuristic clothing looks like is never good. They never do well with this idea, but yeah.
Oh, and I was sad that when they came running through the gate back to the present day, Hammond didn't say to Jack or anyone, "You're out of uniform."
Yeah.
That would have been good.
Yeah, because he never saw them in the hippie garb back in the past. So this should have been a complete surprise to him. A bit of a double take would have been fun.
Yep.
But Don Davis just plays that character as such an unflappable character, an unflappable attitude on things that, yeah.
Yeah, we're picking nits here, but it really is a very enjoyable episode to watch.
Definitely a fun episode, yeah. A fun deep dive episode, yeah.
We've now seen in the future, maybe that was 2077. Shall we go on to Out of Mind?
Yeah, and both of these are sort of about time discontinuity, so they work together well in that respect.
I think in terms of managing the audience's expectation and having little gotchas, this was pretty smart to have the following. When they were trying to have this sort of, you know, ha-ha moment, this was pretty good.
Right.
Most of the other stuff about Out of Mind was not so good, but we'll get to that.
Yeah, let's go ahead with the recap then.
O'Neill wakes up in the SGC in 2077. Really? He is kept drugged while they pump him for information. Well, episode clips. Turns out Jackson and Carter are being treated the same way, but separately. O'Neill never trusts the establishment. And avoids drugs to escape. Yep. It looks like they're on a gold ship with three entire copies of the SGC in it. Teal'c spends 3 weeks healing in the real SGC after almost getting killed when the others were captured. Hammond doesn't know where to look for SG-1, so Teal'c quits the SGC and goes off on his own. O'Neill, Carter, and Jackson are all reunited to get captured by Hathor, and one of them is about to become a gold host. Cliffhanger.
Dun, dun, dun.
This is a weird clip show.
Yes. I hope that this provides some slight justification for having made you watch Hathor.
Absolutely.
Since we see her return here.
What's interesting is this is the first clip show I've seen, and the only clip I didn't recognize was the one with the balls with the extending spears, and I'm okay with that.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, right. Yeah. You didn't need to watch that episode.
It's okay.
Why did they even show that bit? That was one of the flashbacks when he was disoriented, right? Which meant that you were also disoriented, so it works out.
I'd like to start with, unless the show is ending, this is so obviously a trap that I don't know why they tried to play it out so long.
Yep.
Obviously, we're not in 2077, people. But maybe time travel's involved? I don't know. But it seemed so ridiculous.
The idea was, well, hey, they just learned how to time travel. Maybe the way that, you know, O'Neill will get back to his team is by time traveling back. If that was what they were supposed to be having you think, I don't remember thinking that at the time. And it was very obviously overcome very quickly by the fact that, hey, everything's a little wonky here. There's probably something wrong. Not least the fact that O'Neill himself seems to be suspicious from the very first minute, right?
Wisely.
He didn't say anything.
Well, to be fair, the team has been in quite a few situations before where people have told them, oh, the rest of your team died, and it turns out to be just not true. So there's a reason for him to be instantly suspicious.
Well, it's almost as if he knows he's in a TV show where he's one of the main characters.
I like the fact that O'Neill just doesn't trust anything. Like, O'Neill doesn't trust Hammond half the time.
Rightly.
So it felt consistent even in that regard.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. Now, I don't remember if I actually have seen this episode before. I mean, I was watching when it was TV, so there would have been episodes that I missed. And I didn't remember this when I was watching it. Not even remember that Hathor came in at the end, I was kind of thinking of it as, well, this is an odd little bottle episode to end the season on. You know, last end of season, we had a very dramatic climax and part one of two with the invasion of Earth and everything. And this seems very low key for a season finale. And then
low key and cheap.
Right. But then it turns out, oh, okay, there is something going on with Hathor playing games.
You were right the first time. And again, we'll get to maybe more of the details later. But, you know, you think on the end of season one, where the cliffhanger was, and they're already at Earth, and Earth is now immediately threatened. Oh, no.
Right.
And the cliffhanger this time around is, well, which of the members of SG-1 will be ineffectually threatened, since none of them are actually going to die anyway? And I'm like, wow, is that just like a choice that doesn't matter at all? I don't think I would have spent, you know, the year or the 6 months waiting for the next episode thinking, oh my God, who's going to die with the symbiote? No, of course not. Ugh, just so bad.
I'm trying to hold my opinion because generally I found Stargate two-parters, while the first part always feels just a little weak, they generally pull it together pretty well in the second episode. The pacing in this episode is horrifying.
Yeah, they slow a lot of stuff down.
And it's not just that it's slow and boring.
Boring, yep.
And it's just bizarre. Like, you even can't even think that, wait a second, just to pull off this one thing. And there's bits of the underlying plot I like, but to do this one thing, they built three entire separate SGCs inside of presumably a Gould ship. Like, from a Doralist perspective, this is super cheap. We just reused the set three times and we already had the other ship. There's nothing to build.
Yeah.
But from a Watsonian perspective, how many months and how many thousands of slaves had to get used to build this thing?
Well, yeah. And she must have a photographic memory to have gotten the details of the SGC so right,
yeah,
with all this stuff.
Yeah, I think this snake would probably have a very detailed memory of what it
was. Or it's possible her garb actually has just recorders on it. Like, there's built-in LiDAR.
Yeah.
She's entirely tracked the entire building. The point when they start opening doors and there's nothing behind them and they complain about it being fake and it's a set, so of course it's fake and there's nothing behind the doors. Yeah. The efficiency of the reuse of sets,
yeah,
is so amazing.
It's pretty good.
But it's bizarre.
And the gate prop, O'Neill kicks it and says it's fake. And like,
really?
Yeah, it looks exactly like the other one that you said was real. So yeah, pretty funny.
Oh, one call out in 1969. The box that they ship around that gate in is a beautiful piece of set equipment, which I'm assuming is actually the box they ship the gate around.
Oh, yeah.
When they had the prop built. That box was beautiful.
Yeah, it's, yeah.
They climb up it and open up the latches and drop down the doors. That was
That's true.
Beautiful.
Yeah, I liked that a lot.
Sorry, back to this episode.
When did they originally, and we're not going through necessarily minute by minute, but I don't think that's a real shame. There were a couple of moments where they mentioned the combined Serpent and Horus guards. And did Teal'c do that at all? I think Teal'c might have said something about them being both.
Yeah, when Teal'c wakes up in SGC and they are debriefing him, he says that it was a mixture of Horse and Serpent guards who attacked the party.
Horus and Serpent guards, yeah.
Oh, Horus, yeah, it would have been Horus.
Horus guards would have been amazing, but I don't think that's what they're doing.
That would have been a real time travel episode. Yes, my mistake.
I do like that's, you know, that's the indication that things are a little different, that something's weird. It's not their normal enemies.
Mm-hmm.
I also like that they had the quips of the three Gua'uld that they still think are alive. And so it's kind of a, well, which one do you think it is now? And, you know, it is one of them. So I did kind of like that moment.
Yeah, I liked it when Carter was just waking up and they were doing her memories and the scientist mentioned fighting Apophis and Sam said, isn't he dead? And I liked how the scientist, you know, like took a breath and then said,
right,
of course he is. We're just trying to stimulate your memory.
Yep.
But I'm still assuming Apophis isn't dead. So the line almost made no sense anyway. Like, they already thought Apophis was dead and he came back. They think he's dead now. They can still bring him back. So, like, the line just seemed weird to me.
Yep.
But obviously it was just weak covering up. Because this plan is ridiculous.
Yes.
SG-1 would know that Apophis is probably alive again because he was probably revived by Sokar. But they needed to be able to say he was dead because they needed that reaction from the woman. So
mm-hmm.
I suppose. Yeah. When it comes down to it, if you take one of these people as a host, don't you get access to a good chunk of their memories anyway? Like, why is any of this happening? The one thing I really liked in this episode, there's something I liked, because the way it feels it's going is, these are Gould, obviously, Gould, and they are going to try and collect information about the allies and the strengths of people who their enemies, so that they can fight against their enemies and fight against Earth. That's what this looks like. It absolutely is framed that way. And it isn't at all like that. Like, Hathor is using this to try and find allies to fight the other system lords. And I thought that was a nice twist.
Yep.
That one line I liked. That was good. The plan is ridiculous.
Yeah.
Yeah, one wonders why she chose to devote so much time and energy and resources to recreating the base to try to question them. Couldn't she have just used her hand device to raid their memories?
I got nothing. I just got nothing.
Does she still have a hand device?
Maybe not. And there was also the line about she can no longer use her chemical pheromones to influence.
Yeah, she called them an organism, but yeah.
Daniel, at least, and I think all three of them. Yeah. And I just can't think why that would now be true. Unless it's like a, you know, dose you once, you're my slave. Dose you twice, you built up resistance. Sorry.
I don't remember quite at the end of the Hathor episode whether they found a treatment to cure it or if it just wore off. Because if it just wore off, I agree, it makes kind of no sense. Hathor was too powerful before, so we need to depower Hathor, so we'll hang a lantern on something so we can take away Hathor's power, therefore she'll lose.
Yeah, I mean, I guess we can just fanlink it that they knew they were vulnerable to Hathor, and so off-screen Janet Frazier whipped up some kind of injection to build up, you know, an allergic resistance.
Maybe.
Something about antihistamines or something.
yeah, that's what it was.
Or, you know, they wanted to build the episode around this ridiculous conceit of them being fooled that they're in the future, and they were just going to throw aside anything and everything from previous continuity to make it work.
Mm. Yeah, I'm afraid this is all loyalist. There's no plan inside of this episode that makes any sense. And I'm very curious how they're going to finish it, because it'd be interesting to see them actually finish it in a way that's good. I just don't see how they're going to.
Well, now, has Teal'c quit the SGC before?
Kind of.
I think he threatened to quit before. I'm not sure if he actually made it.
Yeah, he almost quit.
I did kind of like one aspect of that scene with him and General Hammond, even though it took too long.
It did take too long.
In that there was that moment where it's like, well, are these also baddies who are going to forcibly prevent Teal'c from leaving?
Mm-hmm.
And then they weren't. They did let him go. So I think that was probably like the only real purpose of that scene, was to have that tension of, is this also a trick? And then have it not be.
Yeah, there were several points where Teal'c was saying, I want to do this. And Hammond was saying, we can't let you do that. And it happened several times. And then finally, Teal'c came up with something that he wanted to resign, and Hammond said, we can't let you go because you have too much valuable information. And Teal'c said, I would die before I gave up any of that information. And finally, Hammond accepted that and did not say, we can't let you do that.
When Hammond was like, yeah, I know. And I really like that delivery, even though it, again, is almost certainly nonsensical. You can, well, all right, it's a little too depressing to talk about how You can't actually keep yourself from giving up information. Maybe a Jaffa is better at that than normal people would be. But I did like the moment where Hammond was like, yeah, you know, like the friendship between them at that moment was really a nice thing to see.
Mm-hmm.
It just bugs me a bit because all of the members of every SG team are a security risk, which you're sending out in the field. They could easily be captured.
Yes.
And they can easily have all this information taken from them.
Mm-hmm.
And then he freaks out about Teal'c.
Yeah.
And the reality is he's freaking out about Teal'c because he is, in effect, the alien character.
Yep.
Not for any good reason, because Teal'c is the most likely to be able to resist being used for information, unlike everyone else in every other SG team. So it just seems strange. I would have preferred Hammond to try a more sensible argument.
Mm-hmm.
I had difficulty watching it because it felt othering Teal'c unnecessarily negatively.
Ugh, well, they don't do that all the time.
Well, yeah.
The other thing about it was Teal'c has said explicitly that he went to Earth to help free his people.
Mm-hmm.
And that goal is still not achieved yet. And even if SG-1 is all dead, like, he can still only achieve that goal by working with the SGC to fight the Goa'uld. Like, the loss of his team, while completely regrettable, does not change that very important goal of his. So in one sense, I really did think that was annoying. that they put that. On the other hand, I totally get them saying, like, no, this was my family. It wasn't, Earth is not my family. This was my family. And with my family gone, I don't have a reason to stay. I get emotionally why he would do it, but, you know, Teal'c is supposed to be smarter than that as well. So,
Well, maybe he feels like he can't really rely on anybody else at SGC the way he could for SG-1 because he has saved their personal lives of SG-1. And we've certainly seen other people on the base who have been willing to turn Teal'c over to the NID or whoever.
So was Teal'c an employee? Like, does he get paid? Is there an employment contract? Did he sign? Like, what is he exactly quitting? Why quit? Let's say, okay, you can go. Like, on leave.
Well, yeah, you can't just quit the army, right?
Like, you can't sometimes, but sometimes you can. Yeah. So it just, I don't know. It all just seems strange. I mean, and we know he's going to be back at the end of the next episode. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So I'm just really curious to see how they play it out.
Yeah. But I really kind of wish those sort of hench people of Hathor's had been more interesting.
Yeah.
They don't really chew the scenery. They also aren't really that compelling. They give the spiel to each of the SG-1 members about the thing. You know, again, there's just nothing that interesting watching them interact with our group. So that was a bit of a missed opportunity, I think. I'm not quite sure what they could have done, but given that some of the writing in the previous episode was such a good use of the characters' personalities, this felt like it was not a good use of the characters' personalities.
And really, even from other episodes of the show, they don't feel like Gauld at all. They speak in the ancient unknown language that the Gauld speak in, which most Gauld don't speak in because they're just speaking in English. Mm-hmm. Yet they never get the vocal effects.
Oh, I don't think that, I'm not sure they're Gauld. I think they might just be servants. I'm not sure they're actually Gauld.
Maybe they're not actually Gauld. Maybe.
Yeah. Although Carter does say she senses. What does she say exactly? I mean, it doesn't matter because again, the details don't matter that much.
Yeah, I thought Carter said they were
okay.
Someone said they were Gauld.
Yeah, Carter said they were, and that's why she had to be knocked out more, because she was previously Gauld, so now can sense them. I don't know what that is involved with Nakoda. That's a Cassandra thing, really, to me. I don't know why. Whatever.
Why Carter has it, right? Because she was possessed?
But I didn't know that the possession from a Gauld specifically had anything to do with the Stargate element.
They mentioned it before with Carter.
But definitely, there's an implication that they had to stop her from sensing them.
Yep.
So it just seemed weird, and they fall like a chump. They kind of get knocked over as a piece of wardrobe, which you then take their clothes from. They're just so bland. It was bizarre.
Yeah. Well, I guess you'll see what happens next season.
They skipped the scene for Carter getting dressed, which was pretty good considering how much O'Neill was creeping on her earlier in the scene.
Oh, well.
That was uncomfortable.
Yeah.
They wanted to really make sure we saw that.
O'Neill, we get to see topless, basically, mm-hmm. when he comes out, because his chest was bare and they were putting like the electrode thingies on him. And again, because this is a PG show, they had to kind of chastely put whatever these blanket thingies were over Carter in order for it to be, you know, be network compatible.
Right.
And then, of course, they had to say something about it. Of course, they had to highlight it, the fact that she was less dressed than we normally would be. And I was like, you know, is the show going to do that? Yeah, the show's going to do that.
Just mildly uncomfortable. Yeah. Like, the show has previously been horribly uncomfortable, and this is just mildly uncomfortable, but it was uncomfortable.
And I think we've talked about how that there was like a podcast or something that actress was in who plays Hathor, mm-hmm. where like one of us learned that, like, you know, she had to basically be peeled out of that outfit.
Yes.
And you know, they got her back into the outfit for this episode because the sex goddess again. So yeah, one thing I can mention is the fabrics in this episode, given that not a whole lot was interesting in this episode, the fabrics were maybe one of the more interesting aspects of it, because like they had these linen or some sort of white, yep. mm-hmm. really interesting texture to those like suits that they were wearing, that like Carter and I believe, what was it, O'Neill were wearing. And this is what the show considers to be futury, mm-hmm. is white linen. And I'm not sure I agree with that, but okay, it's a choice. And then those blankets that they're wearing, like Carter had.
The blankets were great. And the triangular pillows, I love them.
Very uncomfortable. Very uncomfortable. There was like a red glow to the sort of boxes that they were in, sort of kind of matrixy. I don't know if the Matrix had actually come out at this point, but they were trying to make it feel a little unearthly or a little weird with some of the props, basically. And I think they succeeded a little with some of that, with what they had to work with. Oh, and then the big fog thing that they brought the the boxes out of, like, what the heck? Oh, that was supposed to be cryo, I guess. So that was also a bit more atmospheric than your usual, because they did like a crane shot of the, I want to call them coffins, right? But the things that they were in.
The cryogenic chambers, yes.
Tubes.
then, you know, that was okay. That was better than not.
That was where they spent the money, though.
Yeah, maybe.
Was that one room, that one crane.
Okay.
That one chamber. Because everything else they just had to try and make look cool when they walk from one set of the SGC set to the other set of the gold ship set. And then they just have the door open and they just do this massive dolly zoom. As you're supposed to be shocked like O'Neill is when you're starting to see from one set to the other set.
Did they make the lights different? Because there were lights that might have been a little different than what the normal. Maybe not. I just didn't think about it. But
I still quite like the ship that seems designed to make it really easy to sneak around in.
Oh, God. Yes, I thought that. Oh.
I love those ships.
Kills me. This is an advanced civilization. Okay. Yeah. You can just hide entire parties. Why would you design it like that? These are paranoid creatures. Okay. I'm done. Maybe. No, I'm really done.
Okay.
Okay.
We'll see the next episode.
Here it comes out.
I'm looking forward to it, kind of.
So I know that there was a point in the original run when I stopped watching, when I lost interest, moved away, because there are things that happen in later seasons that I only found out about when I started watching again. And I really wish I could remember exactly when it was, but I'm pretty sure that this episode was the start of my disenchantment with the show. Because, you know, season one finale, again, was so good. And the continuation of it was so good in season two. And this was just not. And so this was like, you know, they have the chance kind of once a year to really punch it up and to do something really exciting. And shows were doing that at that point. They were, you know, episodic shows generally had some big thing happen in the finale. Mm-hmm. And this was like, wow, they can't even do this 2 years in a row. They can't even, you know, manage something good 2 years in a row. And I was like, well, maybe they're running out of juice. And we will see whether the rest of you agree with that initial assessment of mine going forward. Certainly, I did eventually watch the rest of it. So it must have had something that appealed to me going forward. But yeah, this is the moment. This was kind of one of the bigger disappointments to me of the early seasons of the show. So,
well, initially on the watch order you proposed for me, neither of these episodes were on.
Yeah.
And the reality is 1969, I loved. So I'm very happy I watched it.
Good.
And this episode, I think I had to watch, but I didn't love it.
Yeah.
I was thinking about how we could cut this down further. And I think we've just decided that, you know, we're basically going to record a lot of podcasts for this show. And I'm fine with that. Our listeners, however many of them there are going to get the full treatment.
Okay.
Yeah, I think that's it. That's it for me.
Yeah, I was just looking through episode titles for the next few seasons. And there are definitely some more episodes coming up that we will want to watch, but I'll need to look at the synopses. Well, I do look forward to watching the next part of this episode and seeing how well they wrap things up with it.
And again, do you not remember the next episode either?
No, I don't. I think I must have just missed some of these episodes. That happens with live TV when you don't have a VCR.
It does.
I just missed some episodes of each season.
Yep.
We're here to help. Sorry.
Yep. All right. Yeah. So we'll catch up with everybody in the beginning of season three in Stargate SG Fun.
Okay. Well, I'd like to thank our listeners, and I believe that will do it for this episode. Thanks again, and we'll be talking to you later.
Bye-bye.
Yep. Bye-bye.